Coming up on this special edition of The Green from Delaware Public Media, we continue our candidate conversations from Delaware's U.S. Senate race, hearing from Libertarian Nadine Frost and the Green Party's Dimitri Theodoropoulos. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also take a closer look at the races for Attorney General and State Auditor with our political analysts, Tom Kovach and Daryl Scott. Plus, a look at the Democratic primary in House District 22. It's all next on this special edition of The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the latest news from NPR. Welcome to this special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We continue our series of candidate conversations, part of Delaware Public Media's 2018 election coverage and the Delaware debates we're producing again this fall with the University of Delaware's Center for Political Communication. We've reached out to all candidates running in statewide races and invited them to sit down with us for an interview. Candidates in each race are asked the same set of questions to allow you to get to know them and compare them. In addition to airing the interviews on The Green, they'll be available at DelawarePublic.org and DelawareDebates.org right through Election Day in November. Today we focus on the race for the U.S. Senate seat currently held by Senator Tom Carper. First up, Libertarian Nadine Frost. She's making her first statewide run for office. She did run unsuccessfully for Wilmington City Council's 5th District seat in 2016. Here is our candidate conversation with Nadine Frost. Well, our first question is always, why did you decide to run for U.S. Senate?
Well, I have two adorable grandchildren, and I would like to make sure that they grow up in the country that I remember from my childhood. And I look around and I'm not seeing that anymore.
What should voters know about your qualifications for the job? Perhaps something they may not already know.
Okay, well, I do have a degree in political science and government with legal studies. I'm also an inducted member of the Pi Sigma Alpha National Political Science Honor Society. I've been actively involved in Wilmington politics for about 5 years now. I even ran for a city council seat a couple of years ago. I'm active in multiple organizations throughout the state, including the 912 movement and Delaware Gun Rights Association. So I'm just trying to bring the message of freedom to our people.
Let's move on to some issue-oriented questions. More than a few pundits and analysts are framing this midterm election as a referendum on President Trump. Do you agree? Why or why not?
Well, to be honest, I'm not a big fan of President Trump, but I can't say too many bad things about him, you know. He is who he is, and he is sitting in the White House, and people are going to vote for or against on multiple different reasons. It may not just necessarily be an opinion on President Trump. I know that his presence in the White House has absolutely no bearing on why I'm doing what I do.
Fair enough. The Mueller investigation and questions about Russian interference into the 2016 election and elections going forward hover over these midterms. To what degree are you concerned about this type of interference in this election cycle? And if elected, what would you support doing to secure future elections?
Well, I can't imagine a time in human history where one nation didn't try to interfere with another rival nation. I mean, that's going back to, the Peloponnesian Wars. So it's something to be expected. It's not new, and I'm sure that other nations have tried to interfere with our process going back to the, revolution. So I don't know what it is that we can do except for, at least keep trying to keep alert as to who might be out there trying to cause problems. But it's not anything new.
A Pew Research Center poll earlier this summer found that immigration was the top concern among voters heading into this midterm election. This issue obviously touches on a number of topics, from the status of the DACA program and the Dreamers and separation of families at the border to the funding of President Trump's border wall, which the president has threatened a government shutdown over. If elected, what approach toward immigration would you seek to pursue in Congress?
Well, as a former law enforcement officer with the Immigration Naturalization Service under the Clinton administration, I have a fairly unique view as opposed to just ordinary citizens. I've been there. I've seen it. I was a deportation officer. I tell everyone my job was quite simply to hunt down the scum of the earth and remove them from our golden shores. My personal opinion is that we make immigration too difficult, too expensive for, you know, people who want to come to our country. And I want them to come to our country. This is the greatest country in the world. And if people want to come here and enjoy the American dream, we should be welcoming them with open arms. The issue that we have is because we do make it so difficult that people have an incentive to come here without following the rules, which is unfair to those who do follow the rules. So I honestly don't have much of an issue with deporting or removing people who come here illegally. I just think we should make it easier for them to get here in the first place. And as far as a border wall goes, you know, we can't have a nation without borders. That's what makes you a nation, you know. If we don't have a border wall, why would we call ourselves the United States of America? We're just another piece of property on the globe. So I don't know if the wall will even have an effect. I think we should just make immigration into the country easier, because all of our ancestors came here at some point from somewhere else. So why are we stopping people from continuing that tradition?
Healthcare also high up on the list of voter concerns. Arguments in a Texas case that could strike down the Affordable Care Act as unconstitutional will be heard this fall. If that suit succeeds, though, it would also eliminate popular ACA provisions like protections for people with pre-existing conditions. With that possibility as a backdrop, what do you see as the appropriate path forward when it comes to addressing healthcare?
Well, as a libertarian, I'm a big fan of the free market system. I think the biggest problem we have with our health care and health insurance programs right now is the overregulation. It keeps the companies from being able to provide the services at an affordable cost that people want. And one of our biggest issues is that you have to only deal with companies inside your own state. My life insurance comes from Nebraska. My homeowners and auto insurance comes out of a company from Maryland. Part of that problem is, with such a state, the pool that the insurance company can draw from is so small that they have to charge large amounts. If they could go national and have customers from, you know, Oregon all the way to Florida, that widens the pool. And if there are special needs, there are going to be companies that are going to answer those needs. Necessity is the mother of invention. And I just honestly think that government regulation into our health insurance and health care is causing more problems than it's ever going to solve.
I also want to hit on trade and specifically President Trump's use of tariffs, which we have seen in Delaware having a negative impact on soybean and corn farmers. What is your assessment of this use of tariffs, both economically and in terms of foreign policy?
Tariffs never work. That's historical. Back in the 1920s, the economy was roaring, and then they threw on some tariffs, and suddenly we had the Great Depression. Why? Because when you throw on tariffs, it just makes a mess for everyone. And so, and it's not like it's a one-way street, as we have seen. The problem we have with our trade is that other nations have made a concerted effort to support their businesses, while in the United States, for some reason, our government seems to feel that over-regulating to the point of insanity is a good idea, and that's detrimental to our system. If the government would reduce some of the regulations that increase the cost of doing business, then perhaps our companies would become competitive again. But for now, the government seems, again, to be getting in the way, and they're causing more harm than any good they could ever provide.
Generally speaking, how do you rate the health of the U.S. economy right now? And if elected, what would your priorities be to make it stronger?
Well, it's hard to assess, honestly, because there's always ups and downs. It's cyclical. And one year, the big industry could be over here, and the next year, it's a completely different world. I mean, 30 years ago, computers were just something that people were thinking about. And now we're carrying them around in our back pockets, you know. And so the information age has completely changed the business landscape. So it's really hard to rate anything because, again, like I said, it's ups and downs, cyclical. Right at the moment, it seems okay. But, again, you never know when a disaster is going to strike or when, God forbid, government does something monumentally stupid that screws it all up again. So you just have to wait and see what happens and hope to respond to anything good or bad as it comes along.
And finally, is there an issue you feel isn't getting the attention it deserves during this election cycle and this campaign?
I honestly think that education has sort of fallen to the wayside, and that's a tragedy because there's one thing we can be certain of, which is that we're going to have children, and those children are going to need to learn to read and write and be prepared to grow up and become members of the society. And no one's discussing, you know, education policy anymore. Of course, as a libertarian, I believe education policy is a state issue, and that the federal government shouldn't be involved in it at all, that we should be bringing that back to the states, because one of the biggest problems with centralized government is that the bureaucrats have to do everything as one size fits all, and they get to pick the sides. And, you know, you can't even say that about one county to the next county. So how is it that someone sitting in Washington, D.C. can decide what is best for children in Delaware versus children in California? So I think that's an issue that really needs to come to the forefront again.
Our thanks to Nadine Frost, Libertarian candidate for U.S. Senate, for her time. Next up on The Green, we'll hear from the Green Party's candidate, Dimitri Theodoropoulos. This is Delaware Public Media. This is a special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. The next in our series of candidate conversations in the race for U.S. Senate features the Green Party's Dimitri Theodoropoulos. The owner of Wonderland Records in Newark is making his first statewide run for office. Here is our candidate conversation with Dimitri Theodoropoulos.
Well, first off, we ask everyone, why are you running for U.S. Senate?
I'm running for U.S. Senate because I think in our federal government, we need a bulldog, for lack of a better word, for the American public. Our, you know, federal representatives and senators are far too much in service of the very wealthy and special interest groups than they are for the 99% of us. And we really need somebody to sit down and watch what's going on. And my main goal is campaign finance reform.
What should voters know about your qualifications for the job, perhaps that they don't already know or would think is important for them to know?
I have been an engineer most of my life, which is engineering is somebody who solves problems. Right now, I see a lot of problems in Washington, and I've spent a couple of years researching this and found the root cause of all our problems is this big money funneling into political campaigns. It's a way that, special interests can give as much as they want to a candidate and leaves that candidate beholden to them. And I would like to be America's watchdog and kind of keep an eye on, them and set up some special rules for Senate and the House of Representatives when dealing with lobbyists.
I want to go into some issue-oriented questions.
Absolutely.
Certainly more than a few pundits and analysts are framing this midterm election as a referendum on President Trump. Do you agree? Why or why not?
I agree, but I also think it's a referendum on our Congress. Senate and House of Representatives, they have a kind of turned away from the American public except during election time. When they're elected, all of a sudden the people that voted for them are kind of forgot and they move on. I believe President Trump's election was based on a shot across the bow from the American public saying, hey, wake up or we're going to remove you guys and put people in that aren't lifetime politicians, people that, aren't going to bend to the whims of the lobbyists to truly drain the swamp.
The Mueller investigation and questions about Russian interference in the 2016 election and elections going forward hover over these midterms. To what degree are you concerned about this type of interference in our election cycles, and particularly this one? And if elected, what would you support doing to prevent it in the future?
We have to put checks and balances on foreign interference in our elections. The way to do this is, again, campaign finance reform. This morning I was listening to the news and there was another, you know, Russian attack and they were able to actually identify who the people were and it went back to the, you know, Russian military interests. And it was attack on the Republicans and the conservatives this time. So, if we're able to find out who these people are, then we should be, our intelligence agencies should be able to block them in some form or another, or at least make it known, if you see this, this is probably who it's from. And things like Facebook, people use that a lot. And when ads pop up on Facebook, people tend to believe these things. People have to start questioning what they're seeing on Facebook. A gentleman yesterday came in the store and told me a very interesting quote. If you don't listen to the news, you're uninformed. If you listen to the news, you're misinformed. So you have to kind of read between the lines and, bounce from station to station to station, and you will eventually conglomerate what is actually going on together.
A Pew Research Center poll earlier this summer found that immigration is the top concern among voters heading into these midterms. This issue obviously touches on a number of topics, from the status of the DACA program, separation of families at the border, to the funding of President Trump's border wall, which the president has threatened a government shutdown over. If elected, what approach toward immigration would you seek to pursue in Congress?
I have a little bit of an advantage here. I am the son of two immigrants, Greek father, Swedish mother. Watched both my parents struggle over language problems. My dad worked for DuPont, never could get those big promotions because of the language issue. My mother spent the last few years of her life becoming a U.S. citizen. That was one thing she wanted to do before she passed away. I think people in the DACA program, if you have been here since before you were 16, have gone through school, been a taxpaying citizen in this country, you need and you have the right to be fast-tracked to citizenship here, because there's several teachers, educators that are still part of this, you know, undocumented, so they say they claim, and they've paid their taxes. They've been good citizens. They've helped this country. Fast track them for citizenship. My father got to be a citizen by joining the U.S. Air Force. Mm-hmm. Now, the fact that we're deporting veterans makes me sick to my stomach. These people have raised their hand, sworn to defend the Constitution, and have done so, and many of them in several tours in the Middle East. As far as I'm concerned, those should be citizens. And we need to make come up with a way or a system to fast track these people that, you know, should become citizens, because it would be nothing but a benefit to this country for most of them, but especially the veterans that have served for this country and then get deported. That's insanity to me.
healthcare also high up on the list of voter concerns in this election cycle. Arguments in a Texas case that could strike down the Affordable Care Act as unconstitutional will be heard this fall. If that suit succeeds, though, it would also eliminate popular pieces of the ACA, including protections for people with pre-existing conditions. With that possibility as a backdrop, what do you see as the appropriate path forward when it comes to addressing health care in this country?
Other countries, other, you know, first world nations like us can provide health care for other citizens. I don't know why America can't come up with a system to do this. We're smart. We're you know, able to do this. We have the resources. Why can't we come up with a system that works? It's, you know, the arguments between the Democrats and the Republicans and blocking each other. And it seems to me that there should be an easy system to come up with. You know, everybody says Medicare for everybody, which I disagree with. I think it should be Medicaid for everybody because Medicare has some holes in it. Mm-hmm. For instance, they're not allowed to negotiate lower drug prices from Big Pharma. Medicaid is. So is the VA, and therefore they pay the lowest prices. There's also something in Medicare called the donut hole, where they will kind of cover up to $3,000, and then the Medicare recipient is completely responsible for like $3,000 to $7,000 bills. And, you know, people on fixed income, that can kill them. We can figure out a way to, and almost literally kill them, you know, if they can't afford their medicines. We can figure out a way to provide, you know, healthcare at a reasonable cost for everybody in this nation without making the boys at Big Pharma rich. You know, how much money do you need? You know, these guys at the top are paying themselves huge bonuses and should kind of let it go.
Also want to hit on trade and specifically President Trump's use of tariffs, which we have seen here in Delaware having a negative impact on soybean and corn farmers. What is your assessment of this use of tariffs, both economically and in terms of foreign policy as a whole?
Okay. I think the first set of tariffs was brilliant. They have, you know, against China's aluminum and steel, which we all know, you know, if anybody wants to do the research online, they actually subsidize their aluminum and steel in order to put other countries out of business. It's a purposely thought thing. They manipulate their currency values in order to be able to ship all this cheap steel and aluminum all over. The tariff for that was great. But I look at it like a two-year-old at the table with spaghetti and they smash some in their face and everybody laughs and cheers and they continue to do it. You know, what we have is our president is doing the same thing. Everybody was like, that's great. Tariff on China for – we know they're manipulating the market. We know they're manipulating their currency. But now you're taxing our allies for things that are necessary and then yelling about Harley-Davidson moving – you know, having to build things overseas in order to maintain their presence in a market. Otherwise, they'll just be outpriced. You know, nobody's going to buy a $40,000 Harley-Davidson in Europe. It's just not going to happen. And now I think these countries are now – fighting back and targeting specific industries, you know, agriculture, things like that, really, really specifically actually to hurt Donald Trump's base. And it's this tit for tat, you know, like a couple of kids playing in a schoolyard. It's not the way to look at it. The steel and aluminum on China, I agree with, because we know they fix their markets. The rest of the stuff, I mean, steel and aluminum against Canada. Canada's our best friend in the world. We should have totally open free borders with them. You know, people argue that with the whole milk thing. Mm-hmm. The milk tariff that they have. And it's – I just think the one was a great idea. Continuing to do this is really going to hurt us on the world market. People say it's not, oh, we'll catch up. But – I don't think we will. I think right now it's a world economy and we can't, you know, close our borders and say just us, just us, just us.
And kind of piggybacking on that, I just want to get your sense, generally speaking, of how you rate the health of the U.S. economy. And if elected, what would your priorities be to make it stronger?
The health of the U.S. economy, if you are just looking at the stock market, it's A-OK. You know, the rich are making their money. If you look at the general populace, the Americans in this country, a lot of them can barely afford to live. They have to choose between things that the wealthy just take for granted. You know, some of them have to choose for, okay, well, I can't afford a car and my medicine. Okay, so I have to get rid of the car. And this is happening a lot more frequent in this country than people think. Even though people are employed, if you're employed at $8.75 an hour, you have to have three people in your family working just to get by. And, you know, it's something that I think – I'm not saying raise the minimum wage. I am saying there's a lot of other things we can do in the economy to make things affordable for everybody. I do think the minimum wage is a bit low. As a small business owner, what I think people don't realize is that when somebody gets paid $15 an hour, it's really only 65% of what it costs the business. So we kind of have to look at that, what they can afford. But I'm certain that there's a system we could sit down on with both sides of the aisle and figure out something, whether it's you know, subsidizing some housing or other things for people that are on this minimum wage. We try and do it now, but everybody argues about it. So let's just figure out a system to help these people, bring them up to a you know, higher income level. And a great way to do that is subsidize college education. Because if you look at the long run, a college-educated person will earn a whole lot more. And guess what? They're going to pay a whole lot more taxes. Now our tax base goes up, and now it's a waterfall effect. I truly believe the whole trickle-down idea was exactly what George Bush Sr. said when he was debating Ronald Reagan. He said it's voodoo economics, and it is. You make the wealthy really wealthy, and everybody says it'll trickle down. It doesn't work that way. They buy jets. They buy, you know, they do stock buybacks when they promise other things just to make themselves bonuses.
And finally, is there an issue you feel that isn't getting the attention it deserves in this election cycle?
Campaign finance reform. It's the ticket. It's the thing that is – if you look at any problem we have in this country, you can narrow it down to the money. You know, basically, our Congress, Senate, and House of Representatives will make a law. This law kind of serves the very wealthy. The very wealthy take – you know, Medicare and Big Pharma, for instance. Big Pharma will take the money. It comes out of our tax coffers, you know, and then turn around and kick some of that back to the congressmen, senators, and House of Representatives. And it's this dirty cycle of them just scraping off the top of our taxes and then, you know, saying, oh, we don't have enough. We have to, you know, raise the debt ceiling when it really could be fixed if we were fiscally responsible in this country. And we got the money, the campaign finance reform through, and it'll probably have to be a 28th Amendment because of Citizens United, which was a Supreme Court decision in 2010.
Our thanks to Dimitri Theodoropoulos, Green Party candidate for U.S. Senate, for his time. Next on The Green, political analysts Tom Kovach and Daryl Scott take a deeper look into some of this week's key primaries. You're listening to Delaware Public Media. You're listening to a special edition of The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. We continue our coverage of this week's Delaware primary by digging a bit deeper into the races with Delaware Public Media political analysts Republican Tom Kovach and Democrat Daryl Scott. Kovach is a former North Wilmington State Representative and Newcastle County Council President and previously ran for U.S. House. Scott is a former state representative from the Dover area. Today we get their take on the primaries for Delaware Attorney General and State Auditor. Let's move on to the Attorney General's race. Four-way Democratic primary, Kathy Jennings, Chris Johnson, Tim Mulaney, Lucretia Roberts, plus now a Democrat running for the GOP in Bernard Pepakai. On the Dem side, a big money edge for Kathy Jennings. Is that the story of this race, Daryl Scott, or is there something people aren't seeing?
I think there's two things that I would point out. One, I think the money advantage is going to be difficult to overcome, and much like in Congressman Blunt Rochester's primary race, the money proved to be invaluable in getting out her message and making her sort of distance, enabling her to distance herself and from the opponents. The other is some consider sort of Chris Johnson's campaign as sort of the one who has been most progressive and has pulled a couple of the other candidates to the left, in Jennings and in Lucretia Roberts. So Mulaney's been sort of the outsider with respect to some of the positions that mm-hmm. he's taken, has sort of maintained that and has held firm. And so it'll be interesting with the movements among progressives, Carrie Harris's campaign, and whether there's some ability or benefit that he can pick up that might allow him to close that gap.
Tom, for the Republicans, is it disappointing that they had a candidate, lost a candidate, then had to take a Democrat essentially and run in this race? No primary, so there's that, I guess, bit of good news for the GOP side. But is that a bit of a disappointment that high up on the ticket?
Well, Tom, I'll give you the political spin answer first and then really answer the question. It's always good when you have two candidates on the ballot to force a vigorous debate in November. Now, for the real answer, I think that the Republican Party itself would have been better served cultivating their own candidate and getting a candidate that, really could be, and they could advertise as a check and balance on the system. You have a completely controlled Democratic state government, and AG is a really good position to come in as a neutral or a independent or even a opposing party and make sure, that, as Daryl knows, the AG proposes a good number of laws that affect the regulatory agencies, and to have that independent there would have been, I think, a valuable alternative choice. The fact that there's five Democrats running, one on the Republican ticket, it's good for choice, and I'm glad the party was able to find a last-minute replacement. But I think we would have been a little better served with a little bit more differentiation in two candidates in November.
But, Daryl, does it set up an interesting dynamic in November where you have essentially almost a second Democratic primary, like a Survivor Series, if you will?
It does set up an interesting dynamic in November, and depending on who the Democratic nominee who prevails, one is, how does Pepkai, distinguish and differentiate himself? How does he communicate a message that's going to resonate with Republicans that will give them a reason to come out and vote? Mm-hmm. And for those candidates that are down ticket, right, whether it be auditor and state senate and state house, you need a strong ticket up front, and you want people to continue down on your side of the ballot. And so if people skip, cross over, so they stay on the Democratic side for AG, and then what do they do for auditor, and then what do they do for state, state senate? So, Republicans, if they have a congressional candidate that they vote for, then they hop over to the other side. Again, so I think it could be an interesting dynamic. I just the other element is race. I mean, you again, unless Chris Johnson wins, you would have sort of an African American running against a white candidate. Say Jennings wins, right? So Jennings wins, and right. You get Pepkai and Jennings. So you've got an interesting dynamic that brings in maybe the city of Wilmington politics, mm-hmm. And then you've got the money advantage. I mean, one is he's starting so late. Kathy Jennings has such a war chest. Depending on what she leaves the primary with, does he have a chance to build a war chest and be able to compete effectively?
Yeah.
I was going to say, Tom, how do you see Pepkai running against whoever survives in November from the GOP side?
Building on what Daryl said, because, again, I as typical, align myself with Daryl's view of the world on these political issues. I think that it just throws in a very interesting dynamic of you have the Republican Party putting up an African-American candidate for a significant position, and does that at all mess with the dynamic or a narrative of a fringe element that always tries to bring out racism in party issues? I would like to see that racism and party issues, be out of partisan issues. I think whatever race you happen to be and whatever party you happen to be should. You shouldn't be defined by your party, what race or whether you're racist or not. So I like to see the diversity in Republican candidates, more female candidates, more African-American candidates. That's fantastic. And to Daryl's point, you know, you're going to have a Democrat versus a Democrat, even one of them's a Republican. Does that strengthen or hamstring the other statewide Republicans? If you come over and you're voting for Bernard Pepegai, then do you stay for any other Republicans? Or, you know, if you're coming out only to vote for him and he's a Republican, do you also vote for a Republican auditor and treasurer? It will be a very interesting prospect. If he had been in the race longer, as Daryl said, with more money, it really could have thrown an interesting dynamic into the race.
I want to hit on the state auditor's race now. That's been overshadowed a bit by the stories involving Democratic candidate Kathleen Davies' dismissal from the auditor's office, her fight against that dismissal, and the stories that have come out about it, including reports leaked about it to the media, reports done about what was going on in the office. How does that impact, again, a down-ballot race that usually doesn't get a lot of attention and is a three-way race that includes Kathy McGinnis and Dennis Williams? Darryl?
So, again, you, as a down-ticket candidate, you'd like to have a strong, you know, ticket above you or candidates above you so that, again, you've got a unified message. You've got the ability to sort of keep people coming down the ballot. This one, as you said, I mean, the controversies around Davies' experience in the auditor's office and her dismissal from that office has overshadowed anything that she's tried to do. And she may very well be the most qualified, having served in the office for 6 years. Mm. But I've tried to stay informed about that race. And the majority of what I hear is just the controversy, right? So Williams wants to make the case that he's the best qualified. McGinnis, you know, one has the most money and the most name recognition, having mm-hmm. run for a primary, you know, essentially been running for the last 3 years.
Right, exactly.
Right, for statewide office. But unfortunately, I don't think Davies has been able to get out from under that cloud that's been related to, you know, her experience in the auditor's office.
And Tom, does this kind of create an opening for the Republican in this race, James Spadola, in November? He doesn't have a primary. He's watching kind of the Democrats, you know, in this kind of contentious, fractious back and forth, not even really about the issues, but just about, you know, the candidates themselves. Does that create a little bit of an opening for James Spadola?
Yeah, that certainly would be the hope of James Spadola. I particularly like and enjoy James Spadola. I think he's a kind of a refreshing candidate, running on his qualifications, you know, not necessarily running on a partisan plank, because, you know, he views the auditor's office as almost a nonpartisan plank. But I think, depending how contentious this race gets, depending on how much it focuses on other things, I think it could distract. But I think, you know, picking up on what Daryl said, Kathy McGinnis now has run for state office. It's not like, you know, she's an unknown, candidate, and she's, you know, she's run in a primary before. She's not necessarily known to all the voters because such a small turnout in a primary, but she's got a campaign organization that seems to be, you know, well organized as compared to, you know, other Democratic candidates. Dennis Williams was obviously in the House and a colleague of both Daryl and ours, mine, and, you know, he has some experience running campaigns, is trying to run on his qualifications, but I don't sense much traction there. But you never know with this contention and two female candidates is gender. We talked about race. We mm-hmm. talked about, you know, party. Is gender going to play, you know, a role in this race? If Kathy and Kathleen are fighting it out, you know, does Dennis, you know, come in and pick up the scraps and have enough to prevail in the three-way primary?
I agree with what Tom said. I wanted to ask whether, you know, Tom, you thought that there might be a hangover effect related to, you know, the Republicans have had the auditor's office for 20 years, mm-hmm. right? And have always sort of talked about being the watchdog and sort of the independent and, you know, the sort of the last line of defense. But the controversies related to Davies
involve
the current auditor, a Republican. So does Spadola have to speak to that and distance himself?
It's a good point.
And does it provide an opening for the Democrat in this race to recapture a seat that they haven't held for two decades?
Yeah, no, very good point, Daryl. Something that, I've been talking with some folks about. Absolutely, anytime you have a controversy in the office, it certainly taints the current office holder and maybe the party that's holding that office. I think if Tom Wagner were seeking re-election again, I think there would be definitely considerable issues with him being the candidate and the controversy there. And I think if either Kathy McGinnis or Dennis Williams would prevail in that primary, they'd have a much easier road in November.
Okay.
The fact that it's an outsider, I think James can come in, not my office, not my issue, precisely why I'm running. If it'll be interesting to see how much James weighs into those issues and, comes to, criticize any of the potential findings that happen and come out before November. Again, from what I've seen of James Spadoli, he's not hesitant about making a differentiation between himself and other Republicans. So, I think it's a good valid point that Daryl makes, but I think James is new and different and not associated with the current auditors enough to come in as a fresh candidate and, a fresh viable candidate. So the auditor's race is a very interesting race, and I think could be a real toss-up this November.
Thanks to Delaware Public Media political analysts Tom Kovac and Daryl Scott. We'll hear more from them on tomorrow's special edition of The Green and during our primary night coverage, Thursday night, September 6th. Stay with us. More primary coverage is coming up on The Green here on Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on this special edition of The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. With Republican State Representative Joe Moreau retiring after 20 years, the 22nd Representative District is up for grabs. And that House vacancy has drawn four contenders, two Democrats and two Republicans. Today, Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt introduces us to the Democrats competing in this week's primary.
Democratic candidates Guillermina Gonzalez and Renee Tashner have very different backgrounds. Gonzalez.
So I embarked myself in corporate America, worked for corporate America for a variety of years. One of those brought me to the U.S., Exxon.
Tashner.
I don't come from corporate America. I'm from Pike Creek, and Newcastle County is where I worked, where I raised a family, and where I volunteered.
Tashner has twice run unsuccessfully for positions on county council. For Gonzalez, it's her first foray into politics, but she comes from a family of politicians in Mexico.
So the notion of public service is deeply ingrained, but I never thought that I was going to be one.
Both Democrats have prioritized the issue of safe communities. Tashner points to her 21 years as a law enforcement official. She retired as senior sergeant with the Newcastle County Police.
When you have officers in the community interacting with the public in non-crisis situations, when the unfortunate crisis does occur, you have already established a trust.
Gonzalez advocates for passage of what she calls the last four elements of sensible gun legislation.
Raising legal age to buy firearms, updating law on unsafe storage of firearms, ban sale of large capacity magazines, and finally, ban sale of assault weapons.
Both Democrats say they respect the Second Amendment, with Tashner stressing the need for responsible gun ownership.
I think we need to educate folks who have weapons in their home, obviously the severity of the weapon itself, but, safe storage options.
As for legalizing recreational marijuana, each candidate is open to discussing the issue, though Gonzalez says she is for it.
Improves consumer safety. It phases out black markets. It could free up police resources And finally, it offers a chance to boost Delaware's economy.
Tashner is more cautious.
You have some very reputable medical facilities, doctors, saying that if you legalize marijuana, then children will start to smoke it at a younger age and it will affect their brain development. You have others that say, no, that's not true.
Gonzalez says she'll bring her business experience to bear with economic development grounded in support for entrepreneurs.
The dependency on large corporations like the AstraZeneca, DuPont and the likes is gone and is not coming back. So we need to keep an eye on small businesses because they make 46% of the economy of the state.
She considers herself fiscally conservative.
34% of the budget goes directly to public education. 30% goes to healthcare costs, and 16% goes to criminal justice. So if you want to be efficient, those are the three items.
She says she'll dig into where the state is spending money.
I'm a free agent that I'm able to ask the pertinent questions because I don't have allegiances to the right or to the left.
Tashner hopes to hold companies accountable for environmental pollution.
I believe very strongly that when these companies close shop, or they reestablish themselves under a different LLC. The state of Delaware should always be first at the front of the line to collect any monies that they are owed.
She wants more collaboration between mental health professionals and law enforcement officials. She also wants more support for addiction recovery in correctional facilities and reentry programs.
It's also a good opportunity when they are incarcerated to give them training, you know, give them the skills that when they come out of jail, they're not just wandering around aimlessly. They actually have something to look forward to, and that's a job.
Tashner says her experience helping a diversity of crime victims over the years gives her the ability to connect with and fight for all kinds of people in the General Assembly. As an American by choice rather than birth, Gonzalez says she brings a fresh perspective and is able to connect with people on a deep level.
It's refreshing. It's like going back to the American dream again.
Guillermina Gonzalez and Renee Tashner face off in the Democratic primary election on September 6th. Sophia Schmidt, Delaware Public Media.
Thanks, Sophia. And that's all for this special edition of The Green. The interviews and stories you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. And remember, you can also check out The Green via podcast at our website, on iTunes, and on the NPR One app. Thanks to those who helped make today's show possible, political analysts Tom Kovac and Daryl Scott, as well as Delaware Public Media's Sophia Schmidt. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Burns saying thanks for joining us. And a reminder, we'll have another special edition of The Green tomorrow featuring candidate conversations with candidates for Delaware's U.S. House seat, incumbent Democrat Lisa Blunt Rochester, and Republicans Lee Murphy and Scott Walker, plus more election analysis. So join us again tomorrow for that special edition of The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.